When Gary asked me to give this talk, I wasn't sure how you talk about the history of all of this stuff. Many of you probably know it, but I think there are a lot of folks that have really just joined into this interesting field in the last couple of decades and probably are less familiar with what has happened early on. So I'm going to try to talk a little bit about some of that. I guess none of this works. We seem to be pretty sure now that the first really recorded observations of noctilucent clouds really only stem from the mid-1880s. And I think it was absolutely amazing that early on, Jesse was able to estimate the height of the clouds at 82.9 kilometers. You know, that's absolutely amazing. And I'm still struck with this whole idea. Why do the clouds stay at about the same height? You know, the whole atmosphere has changed a great deal in that time. Most atmospheric phenomena move up and down with pressure surfaces, density surfaces. This seems to stay very much anchored in geometrical height. And I think that's something that we haven't answered yet. Well, over the years, a great number of ground-based observer systems have been developed, Northern Europe, in Russia, in Canada, and they're doing wonderful work. You know, it occurs to me that this is really one of the few parts of space science that amateurs can actually be involved with. You know, that people can just go out, if they happen to be in the right locations, and see something happening so far above them in space. And of course, I think one of the most interesting studies that's come from ground-based work was George Vitz in 1962, and that's an amazing paper. Some of the work he did on the heights and the actual three-dimensional structure of the clouds has been an important part of the background of all of this. In the 1960s, of course, the space age arrived, and so NASA got very busy and started sending up sounding rockets to capture the particles so that we would all know what they really were. And it's an amazing set of experiments that, you know, if you care to read about it, you certainly can. But what I get from it is that most of the particles that they probably saw, they probably carried up with them. And that's one of the problems. Getting surfaces that you're going to expose to the clouds clean enough so that after you bring them back, you can really be sure that all you see is what came from the clouds itself is a daunting task. And so the more careful they were in how they prepared these different structures that they put out into the stream to collect particles, the fewer particles they actually found. And today we understand that completely because there really isn't very much in the way of solid matter in most of the cloud particles that we see. They're mostly ice. But at that time, they didn't know that. And of course, there's been some very good photometry experiments done from sounding rockets. And sounding rockets have evolved into very, very nice campaigns in which many aspects of this part of the atmosphere have been studied over time. So that's one of the interesting developments. Then in the 1960s, the OGO-6 observations, I think, were really startling. You know, here was a satellite that was looking for airglow and found these tremendous scattering events all over the globe. And it was really the first time that we had any idea that what we could see from the ground as noctilucent clouds actually extended all the way across the poles and pretty consistently in both the hemispheres during these summer months. In the 1970s, I became very interested in a lot of the work that Gadsden was doing, again, starting with ground-based observation, spectroscopy, polarimetry, and modeling. Also, in the 1980s, we began to see a series of models. First microphysical model by Turco et al. Was the first time I think we really began to look at the details of how small particles could become ice particles and what would happen to them over time. This, of course, has evolved into full dynamical and microphysical models, which are absolutely amazing today. In the 1980s, Gary and I also were involved in the first trends estimate of clouds in a paper we published in Nature, in which we talked about the rise of methane over a couple of centuries, leading to a rise in water vapor and the number of noctilucent clouds seen. And that was the first or very early attempt to try to talk about an evolution of the clouds that explained their discovery in the 1880s and what would happen. When we get to the 21st century, we have this series of an evolution of using SPV satellites to detect trends and solar cycle effects that you've probably heard a number of times. But I wanted to extend a table that was first prepared by Deland et al. Just to give you an idea of how rich the number of satellite experiments has become. And these are sort of the earliest ones. And then we go on into the URs and the POEMs. And then there were some interesting shuttle experiments that took place. And then there was MSX and Snowy and Odin, and eventually down here to OMI, which is sort of a follow-on to the SPUV work, and then of course the most recent and in many ways the most satisfying experiments coming from the AIM mission. Well, all of this is kind of dry facts. I decided that since I have the floor, what I would do is give you a little personal history of how I got involved in all of this. As it turns out, in 1966, I happened to hear a talk given by Giorgio Fiocco. Fiocco believed that noctilucent clouds were cosmic dust that was swept up in the Earth's circulation and formed into layers. I heard this talk at a conference that I attended. It was the first paper I ever gave in public. And it's kind of interesting because my wife came along into the meeting, and she settled herself in the balcony in this small auditorium at MIT and wanted to be rather inconspicuous because she was the only woman there, of course. I had the second paper. The first paper was this very tall and gallant German scientist who had come over after the war and was working at Huntsville, and he started his talk by saying, "Lady and gentlemen." And of course, everybody turned and looked at my dear wife, who then shrank down in her seat and has never come to another conference. Then I went on, after that, to do dissertation work studying the mesosphere and lower thermosphere at Michigan, and got very interested in what was going on. It was kind of nice to be working on modeling in those days, since there was no data. You know, anything worked. You didn't have to worry about verifying your models. In 1972, when the first of the papers on OGO 6 came out, that really, really got my attention. And with a grad student, we went and visited the Donahue and his colleagues at the University of Pittsburgh, got hold of some of that data, did an analysis, and published, you know, based on looking at the two different wavelengths that were seen in the limb, that the upper limit on the particle seemed to be less than 100 nanometers. Well, as it turns out, Mike Gadsden didn't like that at all. And in the next several papers he wrote, he strongly attacked that. That was being impossible. They couldn't be that small. They had to be much bigger, or else there wouldn't be enough water to do that. So that was kind of interesting. That got me sort of involved in the in the give and take of what was going on. In the 1980s, Gary Thomas contacted me because of the work I had done at OGO 6 and a couple of other master's theses that had been done under me, one of them by Richard Bevilacqua, a person many of you know, and he wanted copies of them. And he also told me about the SME satellite, which I hadn't heard about. And because of those discussions, he helped me take a sabbatical here at LASP in 83 and 84, and that started a very fruitful collaboration. Being here during those very interesting times, looking at the raw data coming out and trying to figure out what it all meant. So we were able to publish the first really global picture of the distribution of these clouds across the globe in terms of latitude, day of the year, and both the brightness and the frequency of occurrence. And it was sometime during that period that the term polar mesospheric cloud was introduced. I'm not quite sure exactly how it happened, but I remember the two things that led up to it was, first of all, we weren't sure that looking at things from satellites at places where they could not be seen by passive observations from the ground wasn't somehow a distinctly different phenomena. And we were also motivated by the fact that the people who were studying the stratosphere were now calling the clouds that had occasionally been seen from the surface as mother of pearl clouds, began calling those polar stratospheric clouds. So in parallel, we said, we'll call these polar mesospheric clouds. And, you know, I don't think we've ever been forgiven for that, for that term. Well, then I got involved with the POLM satellites, which were somewhat unsophisticated solar occultation experiments. We were only able to get really interesting data, mostly from the southern hemisphere, and it began a collaboration with Eric Shuttle and much closer with Dave Rush and Cora Randall and a number of other people. Somewhere along that same time, we did a three-satellite study. We said, all right, we had this SME data. Now we have new data from SAGE and from UR's Windy. They're about a solar cycle apart. Can we see, in fact, have the clouds changed over a solar cycle? Don't try this yourself, ever. Trying to match the data from different satellites is really, really difficult. We had a lot of fun trying, but that's all I can tell you. We spent a lot of time on it. Sorry. Okay. I had to screw up somewhere. Thank you, Shadow. Thank you, Eric. Then, about that time, Gary decided to try to use SBUV data and wrote a paper with the first of it. And he tried to get me interested in it, but I was a great, great denier that this was a good way to go. In fact, I told him it was like hunting Arctic hares in a snowstorm. But eventually, I had to give in. I had to give in mostly because it was the only data set that around that had the possibility of looking over a very long time, because the data was continuous starting in 1978 and still goes on into the future. And so that began another collaboration with Gary Thomas, with Eric Shadle, and with Matt DeLand. That goes on to this day. So, I guess I want to finish up just by saying that, when you look at history, it's sort of, I think it's useful to say, well, where are we now? What can we say? Well, I think that what we have to say is that there's certainly some things that are wonderful sources of information. The SOFI instrument is providing such incredible details of what's happening in the vertical structure, not only with the clouds themselves, but also their environment. The SIPS instrument is giving us the first chance to really visualize what the horizontal structure of these clouds are over the globe. The models that are coming out of the group at the IAP, the LEMA models, are incredibly impressive in the details that they're able to show. And I think that's a wonderful achievement. There's been a series of particle size workshops that have made some real progress, but I think it also reminded us how difficult it is to talk about what the sizes and shapes of particles are, that virtually none of our techniques is absolutely gives an absolute high resolution answer. And we're still left with the idea that PMC trends are an unsettled science. You know, there are believers and there are non-believers, and we're still all working on it. And I guess that's why we have this workshop today. Okay. Yeah.
Who actually originated the term clouds at the edge of space? Is that you?
I used it very early on, but I think I actually read it in a book by Craig. It was published in the late 50s or early 60s. But I probably was able to publicize it, the term.
We do have a portable mic here, and it would be kind of cool to record some of the discussions that goes on. We have plenty of time for discussion, so anybody want to, I'm sure there's some old hands here that might want to chime in on some of the history and some of the background. Got plenty of time for discussion. And I know that Gerd is probably going to have a little to say about vertical structure, right?
Here you go.
Yeah. This is Gerd Baumgart. Yeah. Basically, I'm wondering why you never used the word LIDAR in your presentation.
it fell out sometime. I was working on this late last night, unfortunately. I was having a lot of trouble with my computer. It fell out. It was going to be in there.
It was certainly going to be in there.
You know,
your first point would be one of these bullets
should have been, you know, the multi-wavelength LIDAR measurements, which I've also thought, you know.
Yeah.
But somehow, you know, sometimes at the last minute things fall out of your talk.
One more historical reminder. JESSE proposed 1896 to use LIDAR for measuring the altitude, by the way. Shining light on the clouds and measuring searchlight, yeah.
In 1896?
Yeah, and then it was tried in the 1960s by an Italian group, and that didn't work out, and finally it worked out since 1989. So I think that's the historical remark to this. Because I'm the only guy. I'm Mr. NLC LIDAR. We share the point. He's the long-term LIDAR guy, and I'm the NLC LIDAR guy. Is that okay? Yeah. So.
Okay, Eric, did you have something? Looks like you're old enough for me. Later.
Yes. Peter Dalin. I just want to remind you that first reliable NLC height estimations were made in 1885 by Russian scientist Tseraski.
Even before JESSE?
Yes.
Okay. I guess I relied on the Gadsden and Schroeder's book that's what they quote JESSE as the first, but so they missed it too.
Yep. No, it was triangulation.
Okay. That publication is what counts. Leslie's paper was published for a letter and... Hold on, Eric.
I believe Leslie had a letter published first, even though JESSE's observations predated Leslie's but you know, it was only a few months difference in either any case.
What about this? What about my question about why the cloud heights seem to not have changed in, you know, well over 100 years when the atmosphere itself has changed so much?
I think Uwe Berger is going to tell us more about that, right?
Yeah, I will try to discuss this point in my talk, but I have to admit, I have no really good answer for this. This is a hot topic.
Because, you know, when you teach classes in atmospheric science, you know, you have to adopt the fact that most of the phenomena that we look at sit on constant pressure surfaces or constant density surfaces and move up and down with those. You know, you would expect that, particularly integrating through that depth of the atmosphere, the changes in the lower atmosphere and in the middle atmosphere got to affect where those clouds form. It's just absolutely amazing.
Well, to be fair, I think we do see some variability due to gravity wave effects. I mean, George Vett, of course, showed this long ago with his stereoptical measurements.
And there are differences between the southern hemisphere and the northern hemisphere. But still, it's not something that looks like it is tied to a pressure surface.
Ted, this is Ted Llewellyn.
I think we need to be a little bit sensitive, actually, in terms of trying to use observations and trends, because many of the observations, in fact, came from Canada. And what people don't realize is that the prairies weren't settled, in fact, until quite late. And so the probability of actually getting any observations prior to about 1928 is really a joke. The settlers were much more concerned about purely and simply breaking the land and satisfying the government so they didn't have to pay back. So in actual fact, the trend data set that we're dealing with is actually much shorter than people realize. And I would turn around and say, basically, until you go to Yuri Vitt's work, that really was the beginning of an attempt to get a trend and the like. And then what Dave Rush did with SME and some of the crazy things that we've been doing with Odin, as you'll see tomorrow. I mean, you know, if I'm not nothing but nuts, then fine. Thank you very much, but I am.
Yes, Ted, your reputation precedes you.